together like these flowers in the garden. But I already told you I ain't writing no more love letters. I guess my pen is running out of ink. My love is something that you can't measure. So go on, tell me what you really think. We could talk about anything. Let's stimulate the moment. Focus on what's important. Like this lust is hella potent. Got me filling up these pages and writing past the margin. I'm going through these phases while my speakers bumping Marvin. They ask me why I'm sensitive. I tell them I'm an artist. Take it how you want it, take it. I'm just being honest. The first time I wrote to her, she never write back. Wrote her a second letter, ask her why she's being like that. Said that she falling in love. It's plain she had to fight that because of prior history and shit she couldn't take back. Asked me for a favor, not to write her again. He said we couldn't be lovers, she'd just rather be friends. Forever taken by storms and I lost her in the cold weather. But she's in my heart regardless. We're seeking for the light, but mostly only find the darkness. Emotions on my sleeve, just to show you when you're home. Trying to make it here. I took a moment for myself so I can make it clear. I got dreams of a $1 million chandelier. Failure is my only fear and I will never disappear. Memories and souvenirs, views from the Belvedere. Shout out to my engineer, it's been one hell of a year. Okay, from Montreal to Paris, Portugal to Tokyo, then ended up in Seoul. Sorry I've been busy, but I've been on the road. With a pen and paper, writing music on the go, oh. I know you can't stop me from the home of the Maple Leaf, where we play hockey. We're frozen cold winters, where some of us bone sinners and others are bone killers. That bang like gorillas, I'm a real go-getter. With dreams of Coachella and hella mo cheddar, I just don't know better. Like, you can never stop my grind. You can never stop my grind. I'ma take what's mine. I'ma go and take what's mine. I think that I lost my, that I lost my mind.
I think that I lost my mind, 'cause we've been wasting so much time. I think that I lost my mind, 'cause we've been wasting so much time. Time is all we have to make these moments last. Too caught up in the moment, yeah. There's nothing left holding me back. Too caught up in the moment, there's nothing left holding me.
Just wait a minute, read between the lines. I promise the truth in it. Let come to see to set it straight. Write it down and ventilate. Smoke a little, meditate. I'm hoping that you could relate to pictures that I illustrate. Words that I orchestrate. Emotions that I emulate. And moments that I recreate. Okay, homie, you could watch me break it down. Break it down. I just need a little soul up in myself. If you didn't know, well, now you know me now. I was searching for something and never found. On the yellow brick road where the journey is so cold that I promised my heart froze in a blizzard with no snow. Like, now I'm just trying to hold on. I'm just trying to hold on. I'm just trying to hold on.
I think that I lost my mind, 'cause we be wasting so much time. I think that I lost my mind, 'cause we be wasting so much time. Time is all we have to make these moments last. Too caught up in the moment, there's nothing left holding me back. Too caught up in the moment, there's nothing left holding me.
We're just trying to hold on. Hold on to what we got. Hold on to what we know. And hold on to what we love.
We are back, we are back, we are back for the final segment of the evening. You are listening to Soul Perspectives here on CKUT 90.3 FM. My name is Kim Dominique Ferguson. I'm in studios with
Renee Jordan.
And on the line, we have LT's, a local hip-hop, jazz musician, singer, songwriter, who's doing big things, has a lot of opinions about what's going on in the world, and puts it into his music, and we've been having an amazing conversation. So, brother, it's the end of the night.
Yes.
We I don't know, the time just goes very fast when we're having really engaging conversation. So, like, what... Where do people find you? Where do people get in touch with you?
So you guys can follow my Instagram. I'm on there quite often. It's LTEZ, so that's LTEEZ official. You can my Facebook. You know, all the good stuff. You know, it's all on the platform: Spotify, Tidal, you know, iTunes Music. You can find my stuff there. I also got a website that's up. Literally anywhere that you think you can stream music, you can find my stuff.
You know what? I had one last question that was really I was pondering about before. Why the name LTEZ? What does it mean?
So my full name is Lee Terki.
Okay.
So it was kind of like an acronym, and like at the time I had another name when I was beginning to make music. And I was looking for something better than my name at the time. My name at the time, if you're wondering, was TNT. So it was just, you know, not very original. Right. So, and someone's like, yo, man, you need something more researchable. He typed in TNT. He's like, yo, like, they'll never find you here. So, like, ACDC, like, a million covers of TNT. So I was looking for a name, and at that time I was rapping a lot at that time, and I was listening a lot to Joey Badass, actually, and one of the guys in Pro Era, his name was Capital Steez, killed himself like on Christmas, I think.
Wow.
And I liked his music, and I loved his name, Capital Steez. So I kind of came through, and my name is Lee Tahi. I'm like, well, LTEZ could sound cool, you know. I'm like, it rings nice off the tongue. You know, I make music that's close to myself, so, you know, it's only right that I'm like, you know, that my rap name is close to,
as, to my name. Very interesting and very far from what I was thinking.
Okay. What were you thinking?
I don't know, because it's more in the way it sounds, like L, the French word for, like, you know, like for a girl, and tease, like you tease women. I don't know.
You know what? In France, when I go to France, tease en France, quand tu tease, it means to drink.
Okay.
So after my show, tease, what's that? Elle tease, on va teaser.
They're trying to get you drunk.
Yeah, they did.
Well, LTEZ, it was definitely an interesting conversation that we had, and you're very much so a very in-depth artist that has really got us, like, I think when you said you make people think about things and go into this introspective mode, the conversation really did go there, you know. You made us think a little bit about everything.
You got to
We look forward to seeing and hearing more of your work in the future. And you did mention that there was one spot that we could go in and see sort of what a live LTEZ production looks like.
Yeah, so actually, on a couple of days ago, on the 18th, so give a bit of backstory. So my EP that everyone can find on all streaming platforms, The Index to My Inner Thoughts, which came out a couple weeks ago. I did a rendition of it live with musicians, so no backing tracks. It was my first time doing that. And we had a bass player that played the upright and the electric. We had keyboard. We had a singer. And we had trumpet. And we also had a drummer, obviously. And we filmed at the Cabaret Lion d'Or. So shout out to the staff that was there. We captured it in 4K, four different camera angles, and we banged out the EP in 30 minutes. Different arrangements, more solos, a lot more musical. And that premiered in Korea. So that was in Korea, and the festival is called Jazzazoom, and they're premiering it right now. So if you guys want to go check that, it's still on their site. You can go on my Instagram, and the first picture you're gonna see is the link to go to that. But also in another week, we're also gonna have a premiere of that live video here in Montreal with Panam 360, which they did in a really nice review for my EP, and also the live is gonna come out on their site with an interview as well. So it's gonna be on Panam 360, and guys, if you follow me on Instagram or any social media, you'll definitely see me talking about it and posting the links as well.
And you mentioned also that there was, you have a Spotify, I believe, where you can hear the inspirations that you had for the album. What is, how do they find those?
So you guys could just go on my Spotify. It's LTs. You guys could check it out. I have my brand new EP that's there, The Index to My Inner Thoughts. You can also go stream my first EP that came out in 2018, called The Half Full EP. And there's also a playlist of about 70 songs, really curated. Like, I'm a playlist dude. Like, if you peep my Spotify, I have like fucking, sorry, I have like 20 playlists in there, you know. So and that playlist consists of all of the songs that I was listening to while creating The Index of My Inner Thoughts. The playlist is actually called The Index of My Inner Thoughts, The Songs I Lived. So yeah, you guys can check all of that out.
Bless. So just shoot out your handle once again for people to know.
So guys, my handle is LT's Official. You can peep that on Instagram, and you can type in LT's on Google.
And it's spelled the LT's just in case they think it was the way I thought it.
So it's L.T.E.E.Z.
Thank you so much for coming in and chatting with us. It was a real pleasure. Yes. It was very refreshing. And
thank you.
Please do not hesitate to reach out if you got new projects coming up. Let us know so you can come back on the air and tell us about it.
And guys, I want to also thank you. You know, I want to thank for you guys having me on the show. But I also want to thank CKUT for being a staple in Montreal community, you know, specifically the Anglo community. Shout out to the Francophone community too. But if you're Anglophone from Montreal, you know how much CKUT means. And thank you guys. And it was my first time on CKUT, and I'm actually really psyched about being on the radio. And thank you guys for your show. And I would like to thank the station for everything that is done in our city. Seriously, thanks.
Yes, yes, yes.
You're welcome.
You're very welcome. If you're just tuning in for the first time, you're going to have to listen to the archives because we are wrapping up the show. We spoke to LTs, a Montreal local musician, songwriter that fuses hip-hop and jazz together. You can find him on all platforms, L.T.E.E.Z, Official.
Yes.
Just Google him and you'll find him. Right now, we have to sign out. Next Tuesday evening from 7 to 8:30, we'll have another guest for you that's going to be coming with some interesting thoughts, point of views, and their own soul perspectives. My name is Kim Dominic Ferguson. I've been in studios with
Renee Jordan,
and you've been listening to CKUT 90.3 FM.
Of our imaginations, what are we chasing? Mental enslavement. Imagine if we opened up our third eyes and seen past the faces. Too many colored lines of segregation. It wouldn't matter if you read the signs or blew your chance, see, it's still the matrix. See, the color of my skin does not define who I am. My ancestors fought for this land so I could stand, see. Those in power no knowledge of self can divide up their plans. That's why the education system won't teach you about yourself. I think it's a scam. They teach us how to work for wage, but not how to manage or invest. The Industrial Revolution made us economic slaves. That's why they take credit for cashing your checks. But we still gotta live our lives right until we have nothing left. Because money is not the root of all evil. The addiction to it is. And they're commercializing childhood and sentimentalism to the kids, teaching them to be consumers before they learn to plant a seed into the future. In my neighborhood, we grew up thinking that happiness was found in material possessions. And a couple of my friends grew up thinking that solutions to their problems were found in automatic weapons. And a couple of my friends grew up thinking that the solutions to their problems were found in automatic weapons. See, bullets had mothers stressing and fear had us guessing until I learned to tap into my spirit to find the answers to my questions. Because see, we are all reflections of one another. We are all reflections of one another. Conceived, the Eve, the Adam was able to walk without a Cain. So now ask yourself, what is love without pain? What is pain without love? What is love without pain? What is pain without love?
Spiral, goddess, your lips sing mellifluous entropies outward, still moon-sickened, hand to mouth as if guarding the morning sun. You are elegant, ebony, blood magic, bright truth. Wry-lipped smile belying universes yet untouched, whole stars spinning in again, reverse deaths denied to remain with wide skyline. Do you know? You are a million rhapsodies of pure silver, that you breathe effervescent sound. I have loved you since the very first birthing, silk-set eyes and clasped hands, you, mother to my every morning, lighting candles in the hours of my darkest grief. Match-burned fingertips and the slow trails of saltwater violence are darkest ties. Yes, sometimes, gratitude means hungering for dusk. And yet, at each sunrise, we found salvation, older than our ages, ocean-bound, greeting morning with wide splayed palms and golden lips parted in salt song, empty hands remembering dawn. But I would sing sweet blue soliloquies for you too, sister, enamored as I am with the intent behind your eyes. Firstborn, spirit twin, the first to teach me how to shapeshift. When is it we became so womanish? Time elapses ambiguously. For so many days, the madness took us, our dreams most potent and wild, interweaving like webs of unharmonious magic, we climbed through shattered membranes hand in hand, twisted sickness into melody. Left our skins in harsh corridors, bled lyricism, cold rooms consumed in silence, we met with defiance and guttural tongues. I know you have reveled in the evening, child of the moon, that we have both ached for nightfall and welcomed darkness with relief, sun spiraling into distant memory, reluctant mourners of the day's last light. You still sing ever-present in the shadows of my eyes, moving through dull slumber with swift abandon, a holy imagining. Are you, too, an angel, or something otherworldly in a body's form? How do we hold so many homelands in such small anatomy, mapping out some place other than this earth on each brown limb? Cartography in reverse. I trace your laugh lines round my palms and spit silk remedies into their open skin while you, my mirror image, breathe your soft prayers to open atmosphere with such implicit faith. We found a god of our very own, heads tilted back to taste sweet sky and sift through syllables of our star-bound namesakes, our slow dedication to untangling histories we were never meant to be burdened with. What magic have we manifested now? And are you light personified? When you next splinter into a thousand strands, do not forget to spiral ever outwards, goddess, and to bring me with you.
I miss your touch, but not literally, so don't take it the wrong way. This isn't anything, so don't take it as such. It is that even as you're not in my life, I still find my mind and heart yearning, regardless of who I meet. But it's not to say I'm riff with strife. I just miss the way vibrations of your voice touch my ears. Those vibrations were always the best beats for the drums that allow me to hear. I miss the way your visual presence touched my eyes, because such a sight can never be replicated. Nor could that touch ever be satiated. Not since I miss the touch that your scent brought whenever you walked into the room. I miss how calming and soothing it was. Hot remained in and on my pillows even after you already left, causing me to miss you too soon. But how can others feel that they understand how someone can touch you on so many levels? How could they understand what your six senses have been through? All right, because they haven't had all their senses triggered. That touch that they brought as a soulmate that one day you figured would come along, but never really asked for. They know, right? Of course. Get over it. Get over the touch of such a soulmate. The ability to move on is something we create, but that's one of the perks of being a wallflower. That no matter who and how many, that your openness can never replicate. You know that their touch can never hold a penny. It's almost as if mentioning of their name is as if you've committed a felony. When I know in actuality, your own senses are still in development. That was mostly an act of someone still going through their own growth and puberty. In actuality, your own sixth senses are not quite developed yet. That the stone isn't quite set when it comes to you and me. This vision can only be seen by us. But how can I know if my own senses of touch can be trusted when it comes to you? I guess it's just one of the perks of being a wallflower. I will, but have no choice but to be patient. For I've experienced something.
You know, I don't want. never ban you, baby.
Jesus didn't die for us so we could be halfway between two places. He didn't die for us so we could not exactly be a total mess or a failure anymore, but yet never really be victorious either. And a lot of people, I think, get stuck somewhere in the middle, and they've got too much of God to go on, to go back, but not enough of God to go on. And so it's very important to me that I do whatever part I can do with the calling on my life to help people be all the
I'm trying to sell myself and I will do it by myself. I don't trust a soul and I don't need no fucking help. I'm paranoid that everybody's out to try and get me. I'm looking over shoulders as I'm passing through the deli. Maybe it's my skin or maybe it's the way I dress. I'm tearing up my limbs and I won't make it to the next. I'm walking down the street and I'm anticipating death. All because a motherfucker looked at me, I said, I go into the void. Fuck! I go into the void. Known as what's passing the strangers. So scared they're acting invasive. Oh dear, they're snatching my face up. Yeah, yeah, I'm happy I made it right under the haste. Head on my waist as I'm planning to escape. Gradually feeding him an ass on the pavement. Panic and greatest the bottom of my face. I'm having a little bit trouble. I saw a man who was sinister and he was bleeding. I thought he was serial, maybe he wasn't. Thought he gonna kill me, then blade in the stomach. The void is a place on the torment. A moment in some of my spirits from where I belong is. Doctors of death, corners of corners. Don't say I didn't want you, just say I didn't want you.
I go into the void.
Fuck! I go into the void. Fuck! I go into the void. Fuck! I go into the void.
And so we might say this is an experience of the void. Before trying to explain what this is, and you know the funny thing is it really can't be explained because it has to be felt. Because it's a transformation of one's basic feeling, one's basic consciousness of life.
Si vous avez présenté une demande d'indemnisation pour des sévices subis dans un pensionnat indien, sachez que les dossiers de votre demande sont protégés. Ils seront détruits en septembre 2027, à moins que vous ne choisissiez de les conserver ou de les partager. Pour en savoir davantage, composez le numéro sans frais 1-877-635-2648 ou consultez le site mesdocumentsmonchoix.ca.
To slow the spread of the virus, we need to press pause again. That's why, once more, we need to stay home and avoid all non-essential travel. Gatherings are prohibited in red zones and are to be avoided in orange zones. And it's important to keep following the everyday health measures. Let's press pause again to curb the spread. Learn more at quebec.ca/coronavirus. Let's continue to protect ourselves properly. A message from the gouvernement du Québec.
Well, you know, Jesus didn't die.
Wake up. Wake up. Wake up.
This is Health on Earth.
Salud en la tierra.
Dinyan en salve.
El saha del alam.
Briut faulam.
Pour la santé sur la terre.
Gesund in health.
Yunhong esai gai.
Afianzuri duniani.
Saúd para todo mundo.
Manquet en daidak nai.
Prithivi mudde shuri ne jokhan.
سلامت در جهان.
زواش زدرانی.
چین کنگ سوژیه.
اپومودین و اساسی سو.
ستروی ناجین.
لا سلوت سوپر.
Health on Earth.
It is 8:31 p.m. and this is Aliza. I'm a producer at Health on Earth. I'm currently a research assistant on a COVID-19 study led by academics and researchers at McGill University and McMaster University. Our study is called Ethics of Implementing Research in a Crisis, Understanding Moral Experiences of Healthcare Providers and Clinician Researchers at the Intersection of COVID Research and Clinical Practice. Our study aim is to understand the moral experiences and support needs of healthcare providers and clinician researchers involved in caring for patients who are enrolled in or excluded from COVID-19 clinical research. Thus far, we've conducted 26 interviews with clinicians, healthcare providers, and researchers from countries such as France, Canada, and the US, among many others. There are five other members of the research team, including co-PI Professor Lisa Schwartz from McMaster University, Research Assistant Tekli Gamir, and one of two research coordinators, Rachel Yancey. Today, I'll be interviewing the study's co-PI, Dr. Matthew Hunt, and our research coordinator, Annie Chenier. Matthew is an associate professor at McGill School of Physical and Occupational Therapy. You might have heard him speak during episode 5 of the Just Emergencies podcast. Annie has a master's in anthropology from McMaster University. Welcome, Annie and Matthew.
Thank you, Lisa.
Thank you.
Let's get started with the questions. Matthew, this first question is directed towards yourself, but Annie, feel free to pitch in. My first question is, what were some of the motivations which informed the creation of this study?
Well, it's great to be able to come back to Just Emergencies and talk about this new research project. You asked about the origins of this project, and we can put that in the context of previous research that we've conducted as a team. We've been looking at various situations in which research has been conducted in crisis situations, and that has been both in the context of thinking about natural disasters and research conducted in settings where a natural disaster has occurred. And through that work, we were led to this set of questions around the interface between research, clinical research, and clinical practice in a crisis situation and the tensions that might arise. And so with that as background, we were really thinking about in the early weeks of COVID pandemic, trying to understand what are the implications of that, those questions and that prior experience from a research perspective, how that applied to the COVID setting. So it was really a spark for reflection. It opened up a series of questions for us. And then with Lisa Schwartz, and then especially with Rachel Yancey, who's a pediatric ICU nurse, really asking these questions. Well, what is that going to look like? How is this going to play out? What would be the moral experience to go to the framing of the study? And by moral experience, what we really are thinking about are these situations where people's values, things that they hold to be important, are being upheld or in some way being threatened or thwarted in the context of everyday life, or in this instance, about clinical practice, research practice, and its interface. So that's really some of the background that led us up to pursuing this project, developing it. back. I guess we started back in April and May, and that we're continuing until today.
Thank you. That was very comprehensive. So this question is directed towards yourself, Annie. What are the key themes or issues from the interviews you've transcribed or summarized thus far?
Yeah, thank you very much. There are some clear common threads already coming through. First, we're learning a lot about the COVID research landscapes and the ways in which it differs from regular clinical research landscapes outside of that, you know, very specific emergency context. So some key elements that we've learned. So intense and sometimes unrelenting news coverage around COVID, disruptions in participants' personal lives due to public health and other related measures, fear for their own, their colleagues, their loved ones' health. So I'd say one first set of findings that we're getting relates to participants' motivations for conducting research or for becoming involved in some way with that research. So almost universally, participants describe feeling pressure to do something in the face of COVID. And many saw research as either a tool for doing something, or in some cases, an added challenge that made it more difficult for them to do what they saw as, you know, what they should be doing. So in some cases, research was for participants the best way to gain access to possible therapies so that they could offer something potentially effective to their patients. And again, it's important to keep in mind that high level of uncertainty around what treatments may or may not be effective, and early on even what diagnostics may or may not be effective. For others, research was the best way not just to get access to potentially effective treatments, but to fill important knowledge gaps around COVID, and therefore to contribute to improving treatment guidelines. And for that group, there's really that tension with the need to kind of quickly share results and the desire to produce results that will be usable quickly. Another set of findings relates to the ways in which COVID-related public health precautions have changed and often complicated the role of frontline researchers, especially of people who primarily see themselves as clinicians. So research roles were often transferred to that would normally have been taken on by members of the research team. Were due to public health and other measures often put on the shoulders of clinicians who, because, you know, you're trying to cut how many people are going into and out of the hospital, and even more so into and out of patients' rooms, you're trying to, you know, ration PPE, so you can't have an extra person. So all of these things mean that those clinicians are taken on roles, including around informing participants about studies, going through the consent process with participants, and then administering potential treatments and collecting data. And so these are roles that are often, especially around kind of consent and information, complex roles that require these, like, very personal interactions. They're roles that have a lot of potential for moral complexity. You're helping guide someone who is themselves isolated due to COVID through these, you know, complex decisions. And so we're hearing a lot around how that has affected both kind of the research process, but also the people who are at the front line of that work. And then the other thing that seems to be happening that's an interesting tension is that because there's been so much investment in COVID research and in facilitating COVID research, so on the part of institutions like hospitals, universities and funders, and research ethics boards, what we're seeing is this kind of situation where all of the energy that normally goes into all kinds of research is being poured into COVID research almost exclusively. So everything else is interrupted, often for good reasons. You don't want extra people going in hospitals. But the kind of end result is that there is a good side to having important and useful research being conducted and allowed to be deployed, but you've also got a potential harm in that you're really exacerbating pressures on that small number of frontline workers who are being solicited by multiple research projects. And what is luckily still a relatively small number of potential participants who are also being solicited sometimes by multiple studies. And so all that said, analysis is ongoing. We're looking forward to learning and sharing more in coming months.
So this question is addressed to the both of you. How do you see the study connecting to concepts of justice?
Well, maybe I can start and build on what Annie has been saying. I'm going to emphasize two aspects in particular. You know, obviously, this is in a broader circumstance where there are all sorts of questions of justice that are circulating around COVID. At this current moment, we're thinking especially around vaccine distribution, which is the result of research, right? So we're thinking about justice questions relating to who's going to be prioritized and how we're going to distribute a vaccine. And if we back up and we're thinking about actually the nature of research and research production in the context of the COVID pandemic, there too, there are questions of justice. And so the two that I would emphasize that come forward in the interviews, the one that does refer back to what Annie was speaking, is really questions about what is being prioritized or what was prioritized in terms of research questions. So in this context of recognizing that there is there are burdens associated with research participation for patients, there are burdens associated for healthcare providers, the extra time it takes, the extra tasks that are involved. It is using resources, financial resources, time resources, PPE in certain contexts. So we're just sort of like acknowledging all that. And so one of the things we think of in terms of the ethics of crisis research is that the justificatory bar, that is the threshold that justifies the initiation of a particular research project, is raised. So we need a stronger argument. The rationale needs to be more robust to initiate research, especially in a clinical environment. Mm-hmm. So that requires some sort of assessment and prioritization. And so what are the research questions and topics that should garner those resources and be prioritized in these settings? One of the things that participants spoke about was a concern sometimes, especially in the early days, that there were missed opportunities because research wasn't pulled together in a robust, or to use the phrasing of one of the participants, in a formal enough way. So there were some missed opportunities. So we have participants who are saying strongly that we need research, and we need research that is going to lead to knowledge that's going to have a clear impact on care provided to people who are affected by COVID. So it's like, what questions are going to be important, and how do we get those questions answered in an effective way? The second piece that I would bring forward is around actually, you know, in the context that we have unproven but potentially beneficial interventions that we're testing in the context of COVID research, there are questions about inclusion and exclusion in research studies. And so there's some of the aspects that were emphasized by participants. There were sometimes questions raised in terms of people who couldn't participate. So to give you two tangible examples of people who might be in situations of vulnerability and might actually be at higher risk in some regards, there was an example of people who might rely on translators because of language barriers in terms of, and so that might be a barrier in terms of the consent process and potentially understanding and participating in research. And then the second was in a national context where people who didn't have official registration within the public healthcare system, even if they were admitted to those units, wouldn't have access to the opportunity to be included in a study. So if they were an undocumented migrant, if they were refugee claimants, that they might not have access to study participation. So those were worries about exclusion and the implications if these are unproven yet potentially beneficial therapeutic interventions in an instance where there are limited treatment options. And then the second were people saying it from the positive side. They were emphasizing situations where they were, as much as possible, making opportunities for sort of wider inclusion So there's plasma related trial where they emphasize that people who were pregnant would be eligible. People who even if they had a do not attempt resuscitation or do not intubate orders, that they if they were still willing to accept active treatment, that they could still be eligible to participate in the study. And that was described from the perspective of equity and people emphasizing concerns for equity in terms of people having the opportunity to participate in such research. So those are two of the elements that I think connect up with concerns of justice. And any, are there other aspects that you would layer in there?
One or two perhaps, but I just wanted to stress absolutely how much that concern for equity is expressed directly by participants. And, this was explicitly something that informed their work in designing studies and in enacting them. So other things, just looking. So one, and this might be one that you end up cutting, but I'll just put it out there. So in terms of that equity and access to potentially effective treatments, Matthew talked a lot about how kind of within trials, there's that effort to not exclude people for no reason or exclude people unjustly. There's also in this context where people are engaging with clinical trials as a way to get access to interventions. And we've had at least one example of one participant from a global South country who worked really hard to bring a particular COVID trial to her hospital because engaging with research was the only way to get access to that treatment. So there's that kind of level of the individual potential participants being excluded or not in research, but there's also at that kind of larger level of what gets, once something gets defined as research, you open possibilities for access to specific treatments that would not necessarily have been available otherwise. And then in our kind of unequal in many ways global landscape in terms of who is able to launch a trial, who is able to join a trial, kind of what are the, we need to consider the impacts of that particular power, I guess, that research has to kind of unlock resources. So that's kind of like a small thing. And then I guess the other thing that I wanted to add just really quickly is that one thing that we're seeing is that health systems that are more just do create possibilities for research that is more just. Again, because having prior research and other relationships enabled people to quickly and effectively launch studies during COVID, we've seen a few examples, and there's one of a study. So this was a trial that was built in a conversation between frontline clinicians and researchers, and it was a trial to study the effectiveness of rapid testing as a means of reducing transmission in high-risk settings. So this was a trial that was based in homeless shelters and networks serving homeless people, and it was launched really quickly in response to worries that had been shared by frontline healthcare providers and by shelter users, and has been already produced some information in terms of that can support similar programs elsewhere. But it's just one good example of a setting where having kind of those working relationships set up enabled kinds of studies that might not otherwise be on researchers' radars to get launched. So you have that other dimension of justice as well in terms of defining study questions.
Okay, thank you, Annie. One thing I found interesting when you spoke about just research is the idea that health systems which are more just create more just research. Could you please elaborate on that a little bit?
Yeah, and that is like a wild oversimplification, I think, of something, but I think it is kind of showing up in situations where people with different kinds of expertise, so people who are the front line, and I'll go back to that example of that study on transmission in homeless shelters, where health systems, where the concerns and ideas of people on the front line can be taken seriously and can be communicated quickly, kind of vertically, I guess, across different types of expertise and professional seniority. That type of health system or kind of relationship, that set of relationships within a health system enable that rapid mobilization of ideas. They enable people to quickly act on observations that are made at the front line. They enable the voices of kind of potential participants, in this case, the shelter users, again, to kind of communicate or be communicated more readily than systems that are much more kind of segregated in terms of expertise or level of seniority. But this is very much kind of expanding on a few stories, but it's just interesting to see that what has happened before really does shape what is possible once crisis hits. And so if we want to work to create health systems that can better respond to future crises, being attentive to how kind of just they are in non-crisis times is extremely important.
Okay, makes sense. This leads on to my next question and the final question we have for today. It's directed to the both of you. What are some of the implications for policy and practice that you see emerging from the studies so far?
Andy, would you like to jump in this time?
Sure. So I think in terms of policy and practice, I'd say there's definitely, so in terms of more practice than policy, there's absolutely a need for resources to support and kind of educate about their roles, the frontline workers who are going to be drawn into taking on expanded roles in research. So kind of anything from explanations of that role and kind of like information tools to support them, all the way to opportunities for them to discuss some of the troubling things that they experience because of their engagement with research. So there's really a need for kind of a diverse and easily accessible set of tools aimed at frontline healthcare workers who get invited into taking on roles in research.
Maybe I can build on that for a second. That seems to be an interesting set of implications from the study, which is absolutely the case. And yet there's this tension sometimes too, the people feeling like, oh, more information, or just providing people more, broader in services, and it's not clear that patients will actually be enrolled. And so there's a worry that even too much like information could be a form of burden. So then how do you tailor it for effective communication that's really on point for the areas of concern? I do really appreciate Annie's second point too about offering support, opportunity to share, and what we might say is like making moral spaces, opportunities for sharing the sorts of tensions that people have. The essence there too of like what sort of support, like what are the areas where people are expressing the need for support? One of them that comes across for those frontline providers, with some of these dynamics about like ongoing monitoring of consent, especially in the context where family members aren't present, there's more just, PPE and all the challenges around communication. So that sort of process around not just the initial moment of an informed consent, deliberate process, you know, encapsulated process, but on an ongoing basis, especially with further, maybe it's blood draws or other activities. And specifically there too, with patients who are experiencing delirium or patients with dementia and the challenges of involving the families and sort of that enters into the communication space and people are feeling like the need for support around those questions. So that's an example of a particular domain in which sort of targeted support might be especially beneficial. I don't know, Annie, if you want to layer more in about communication, but I think that is a theme that comes across very strongly. Like we're talking about supports and some of it is around sharing information, communicating information. One of the senses that comes across too is that healthcare providers participating in research, one of them talked about being, I'm just part of the wheel, just feeling like they were a cog in the wheel of research and wanting more information also about like what was learned through the study or how things emerged, especially for these broad international studies and feeling like it would be important actually to have some understanding of the broader process of the research and what was being learned through the research.
Yes.
Yeah, Annie, do you want to say more about communication or layer into another aspect of practice and policy?
Sure. Well, I'll kind of the flip side of that communication, but I'll say that that is absolutely that kind of frustration with not knowing what happens next has been expressed by many participants, including people with kind of like a long history of engagement with research. So it is a longstanding and serious issue for research more broadly and COVID research. I think the flip side of that kind of communication and something that's come through as a success in some situations, a challenge in others, is in terms of researcher familiarity with the clinical process. And this is an insight that Rachel Yancey has shared and that is really I'm going to try to phrase that correctly. You can like erase, let's restart. But yeah, so this is something that Rachel really identified, both in terms of researchers' familiarity with and understanding of the work that healthcare providers do, but also in terms of different healthcare providers' understandings of what the frontline workers, who are often going to be nurses, actually do. And so there's often an underestimation of the amount of work, the complexity of the work, and the kind of degree to which the work involves the whole person and is not something that can be kind of checkmarked and done. That is seems to be something that frequently happens both from researchers and kind of unit managers, sometimes physicians. And so that's something that is going to be, that's an area where there's a possibility for kind of future tools, but also future kind of experiences, possibly something like second dementia during non-COVID times, but really to build that capacity on the part of researchers and research involved people to kind of understand the richness of the work done by frontline healthcare providers and to so that they can better design around that work, design their studies around that work and better kind of support it. So that's one other area where there's a lot of room for new tools and new programs that could be beneficial in the long term. And then unrelated, but there's a lot in terms of a kind of higher level coordination, either between trials or between institutions that are kind of hosting multiple trials or supporting multiple trials. And what we're seeing is that pre-existing programs, so some of which had been set up, well, in Canada in response to things like SARS, but to set up in response to prior emergencies, have been drawn on and have enabled people to really mobilize resources to move things through, for instance, the ethics review process more quickly, but not less rigorously. So this is one area of policy where prior calls have been taken up by practitioners and where improvements have been, you know, have had like a manifest impact on COVID research. So that's something where I'm sure we will be able to identify from participant stories opportunities for kind of refining possibly some of those policies, but where we have seen positive impacts from
spread of the virus, we need to press pause again. That's why once more, we need to stay home and avoid all non-essential travel. Gatherings are prohibited in red zones and are to be avoided in orange zones. And it's important to keep following the everyday health measures. Let's press pause again to curb the spread. Learn more at quebec.ca/coronavirus. Let's continue to protect ourselves properly. A message from the Gouvernement du Québec.
Good evening. The time roundabout now on your dial should read 9 p.m. You're listening to Hotel the Blues here on 90.3 CKUT FM, broadcasting from a small wee little house nestled on the side of Montreal's Mont Royal on unceded Mohawk territory. To kick tonight's program off, we're turning to Lefty Dizzy from a live version of his number, We're Gonna Boogie. Hope you dig here on 90.3 CKUT FM.
I told my partner, I said, man, let's stop in here and see what's going on. So we stopped in and sat down. The waitress brought us over a couple drinks. The music got good to me.